I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, leaders of the intelligence community briefed President Obama and President-elect Trump and released a declassified report about the Russian hacking of the 2016 presidential race. The report concluded with high confidence that Vladimir Putin ordered a campaign to influence the outcome of the race to, quote, undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. For weeks, Trump claimed Russia was not implicated in the hacking, criticized the agencies involved, and sided with Julian Assange, who said the Russian government was not the source for WikiLeaks. On Fox News Sunday, host Chris Wallace grilled Reince Priebus, Trump's incoming chief of staff, about Trump's reluctance to accept the intelligence findings.
Does President-elect Trump accept the evidence that he heard? Does he find it persuasive that Putin's interest towards the end of the campaign was to help Trump by discrediting Clinton?
I haven't asked him about that, Chris. I mean, he accepts the fact that Russia and other entities engage in cyber attacks in the United States all day long. He accepts the fact that this particular case was entities in Russia. So that's not the issue.
Shane Harris begins our conversation, senior writer for The Wall Street Journal, covering intelligence, national security, and cybersecurity. His latest book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex, explores the front lines of America's new cyber war. And Shane Harris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So does Donald Trump now accept the findings of this, of the intelligence community?
Well, it was hard to know exactly from Mr. Priebus' comments on whether he had, in fact, fully accepted them. But you heard what he had to say, and the president-elect put out a statement that didn't exactly embrace the findings, but didn't refute them either. And intelligence officials I've talked to this week see this as generally a positive sign that he seems to be, at the very least, not coming out and trying to reject them and question the integrity of the intelligence community in doing so. So I think it's fair to say he has inched closer, perhaps, than he was last week to accepting these findings. And as he himself has said, he wants to get past this and move on with the business of building his administration.
Now, there were two reports, the classified and the declassified. What is the difference? Do we know?
Well,
do you know?
Yeah. Yes, we know quite a bit about the differences at this point, because what we saw publicly was sort of a version that contained conclusions and assessments without showing the intelligence community's sources and methods for how it arrived at those conclusions. So sort of the end product without showing the work. And our understanding is that the classified version, which is longer, it's about 50 pages in length, so it's not a very long document, but it's longer than the public one, does show more of those sources and methods, talks a bit about the fact that investigations into the hack are still ongoing, talks a bit more detail about how they believe they know the information the emails got from the DNC and the Podesta campaign to WikiLeaks. So it does give some more detail on that. And we know that in the briefing that President-elect Trump received, he would have been able to ask questions about those sources and methods. So he would have been able to ask the intelligence officials briefing him, how do you know this? Why are you so confident it was Russia? Show me some proof, some indicators. And they would have been able to share that. We still don't know exactly what happened in that meeting, but if he did, President-elect Trump did come out of it feeling more persuaded, I think it's safe to assume that it was a pretty effective presentation.
Would it be fair to say that the report said that Putin preferred Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton?
Yes, it is. And in fact, the unclassified version says that. It says he developed a preference for Mr. Trump early on, around June or so in the campaign, even before the nominating conventions, and that in the words of the report, he aspired to see President Trump elected. Now, that's not to say that it was only about trying to get Trump elected. The report goes on to talk about how Putin seemed to hold a grudge against Hillary Clinton, wanted to also kind of wound her presidency or handicap it before it even began. It's pretty clear that the intelligence community has assessed that the Russian government believed Hillary Clinton was going to win, and that where they could, they wanted to try and harm her chances, but they seem to be preparing for a Clinton administration, not a Trump administration.
There have been stories or reports or ideas that there was some kind of tampering with voting machines. And I remember there were, even before the election, there were some stories that were published. What do we know about that now?
Well, what we know is that the voting machines themselves, where you actually go on election day and push a button or make your choice, there's no indication that those machines were compromised. There were concerns about that because for years there have been concerns that those machines could be hacked or the software that they use is vulnerable to hacking or to manipulation. So there were concerns about that. Where there was evidence that the intelligence communities collected of tampering with election-related systems were hackers believed to be in Russia accessing voter registration files. So think of these as when you go on election day to vote and you give the person there your name and they check you against a paper or a computer record, that piece. That's not connected to the vote tabulating machines, but it was still of enough concern that last fall Homeland Security officials publicly warned states that they had to do a better job of protecting these systems. The report that the intelligence community released last week did not find any evidence of tampering with the voting tabulating machines, and importantly, it did not try to make an assessment of whether or not the Russian influence campaign, as they call it, which is the hacking of emails, the leaking of emails, the spread of fake or questionable news, they didn't assess whether that had any impact or change on the voting results either. So these ideas got a bit conflated, I think, in the end, and President-elect Trump himself said that the report showed no evidence that any of this influence campaign had an effect on the election. That's not actually something that it tried to assess, though.
In fact, let me quote from the report. They said, "We did not make an assessment of the impact that Russian activities had on the outcome of the 2016 election." Is that what you're referring to, Shane?
Exactly. It is not a question that they sought to answer.
And I mean, a lot of people thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, and it looks, based on this report, that the Russians felt that way as well.
Absolutely. And one of the things that led them to conclude, I think, that this was not just a campaign, the intelligence agency said, is that this was not merely a campaign aimed at helping Mr. Trump, was they have intelligence that tells them that the Russians, like I think probably most people in the United States, believe that Hillary Clinton was going to win, that the campaign seemed to be targeted at trying to discredit her and also trying to discredit the Democratic Party, under the assumption that once she became president, they would be in a position to try and weaken her or to use these leaks selectively against her. There have been reports that when it turned out that, in fact, Mr. Trump won, there was celebrating in Russia and people were pleasantly surprised by that. I don't think that contradicts the findings that they were also trying to hurt Secretary Clinton. What's also interesting is that they don't go into this, but I think that a lot of people who I've talked to presume that the Russian hackers were, in fact, gathering information on Republicans as well, and possibly even on Mr. Trump. But the fact is that that information was not leaked in the quantity that it was for the Democratic nominee, Secretary Clinton, which again led the intelligence community to believe that this over time did evolve into a campaign aimed more at damaging her candidacy and not trying to damage his.
One of the explanations I've heard is that the Democratic National Convention was vulnerable to attack. They didn't have the kind of safeguards that the RNC had. Do you think there's some truth to that?
There is some. I mean, looking back on this now, technical experts have looked at the computer network defenses that the DNC had in place, and they weren't sufficient, obviously. And I think that there was a lot of room for improvement. It is the case, and I did some reporting on this, that the hackers who targeted the DNC and stole emails from those networks used similar tactics to try and steal networks from the Republican National Committee. But two important things happened. One is the computer defenses at the RNC did catch some of those emails that were incoming to try to trick someone into divulging their password. So it sort of got stopped by the perimeter at the spam filter level, if you like. But also what the investigation found is that those Russian hackers only went after one individual at the RNC, and that person hadn't even worked there for 8 years. So what you see is an effort to try and get into the RNC's emails, but one that is not nearly as robust and as sustained as the effort to target the DNC.
And the Obama administration response, they have been criticized for being a bit flat-footed.
That's right. There's been a long-standing issue in the United States of Russian hacking. The groups that were linked to the DNC have targeted U.S. government agencies and departments. Russia hacks government organizations. That's not a secret. And there were a lot of people over the years who thought that the Obama administration hasn't done enough to publicly call out Russia, to name and shame them, as some people wanted them to do, and to say, look, we have to put a stop to this. So there's an element now that looks at this and says, well, if the administration had acted sooner, might Russia have been deterred? I don't think we can know that for sure. But, you know, the response that you're seeing from the Obama administration now in terms of sanctions and calling out Vladimir Putin by name with this, that's new. That is not something that the administration has done in the past.
Can we assume the Obama administration has been trying to hack the Russian government or even Vladimir Putin himself?
Oh, I think we can definitely assume that, and they won't deny that. I mean, the Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, testified last week that all countries, including ours, engage in espionage and intelligence gathering. We hack foreign governments to try and learn their secrets. They do the same to us. The line where the U.S. intelligence officials have kind of drawn it now is that the difference is that we don't then selectively leak that information to try and affect political outcomes. Although what's interesting is that you hear people talk about one of the possibilities for retaliation might be by the United States for these hacks might be leaking information about Vladimir Putin. So at the same time that we're saying we don't do this, you hear people discussing this as a possible option, which I think is important to note.
You wrote a book a couple of years ago, At War, and one of the things you said in the book is the internet has become a battlefield, and it seems that's exactly what we're talking about here, yes?
I think so. This has become a terrain for intelligence gathering, and it has been for a while. But now what we're seeing in these so-called influence campaigns or active measures, the leaking and the spread of fake news by the Russian government, is that they are absolutely view this as a space to try and gain advantage, to try and manipulate public opinion, to persuade people, to damage people publicly. That is not new, but it is new in the context of the cyber battlefield, and it is reminiscent of Cold War espionage tactics, really. We're seeing these come back, but now playing out in this electronic domain.
Would you say the Russians are winning this cyber war?
Oh, they seem to be having quite an advantage over us now, I think. I mean, it's really, this has impressed a lot of intelligence officials I talk to, and I use that word, you know, carefully. They're not positive on what the Russians did, but this was an impressive campaign. It's, if you're sort of been highly coordinated, sustained, very aggressive, controlled from top levels. As far as an intelligence operation goes and the tradecraft of it, they did a pretty remarkable job. Now people will debate whether or not it tipped the balance one way or the other, but it certainly created a whole series of conversations and disruptions in our presidential campaign that we'd never seen before.
Almost out of time here. More revelations to come, though, do you think, Shane?
I think most people assume that there very well may be. I think it would be unwise to think that the Russians did not collect information on Donald Trump or on other figures. And there may be people even in the Republican Party, senators who are talking about tougher sanctions. If the Russians have information on them, I think you have to presume that they at least might try and selectively use it to damage those politicians as well.
Well, Shane Harris, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thanks a lot. It was my pleasure.
Our pleasure as well. Senior writer for the Wall Street Journal, excuse me, he covers intelligence, national security, and cybersecurity, wrote a book called At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. We're going to talk more about Russia and U.S.-Russia relations after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Now we want to talk about U.S.-Russia relations, Vladimir Putin's motivations for the cyber attacks, and the way forward in the new Trump administration. Joining us is Matthew Rojansky, director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, where he studies U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. Matthew Rojansky, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Very happy to be with you.
Happy to have you with us. And also with us is Catherine Stoner, senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University and at the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at Stanford. She studies Russia domestic and international politics. And Catherine Stoner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499, the phone number to give us a call. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matthew, let me begin with you. I was talking with Shane Harris from the Wall Street Journal about what we know from the both classified and declassified reports from the intelligence community about Russian hacking into the presidential election. Would you say the Russians succeeded in undermining our confidence in the electoral process?
You know, I'm always reminded when I look at these modern day manifestations of what does smell more and more like kind of Cold War spy versus spy, trying to fight and undermine each other at every turn. I'm reminded of this moment at the height of the Cold War. It was 1979, and a KGB defector named Stanislav Levchenko comes to the United States, and he tells the FBI, look to your weaknesses, and there you will find the KGB. And I think that that message resonates today in the sense that there's no doubt that the Russians have been behind a number of efforts to discredit and basically take down the United States a few pegs in terms of both the integrity of our domestic democratic process. It weakens an American president, whoever that president is, as an adversary, as a counterparty in negotiations, if you can damage the process by which he or she ends up getting elected, in this case, Donald Trump, but would have been just as much the case if Hillary Clinton had been elected. But it also, I think this is critical for the Russians, because at the end of the day, their interests reside close to home. It also weakens the American case in Europe, in the former Soviet periphery, so including Ukraine, Georgia, Central Asia, the Caucasus, et cetera, to say, look, we have figured out how to do democracy, free market capitalism. We have a model that works. You know, partner with us, engage with us in business, engage with us in politics and in diplomatic relations, and we will help you. We will offer an open hand. You know, the Russians are really trying to take down that message, and I think a lot of what they do, both in terms of hacking, which strikes at all kinds of weaknesses, unpreparedness for cyber conflict, hyper-partisanship in our country, where the slightest embarrassing disclosure is exploited without any effort by the Russians, is exploited by the other side politically. And also, I would say that the weaknesses of our having, brought about, intentionally or otherwise, a major global economic crisis, the pieces of which are still being picked up today in Europe and much of the world, as well as in this country. And then, of course, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which really damaged the credibility of the American kind of state-building model and the model for solving problems that matter to people. So at the end of the day, what the Russians are doing with this whole package is attempting to undermine this kind of image, this model, and credibility that Americans seek to bring to our foreign policy.
Catherine Stoner, let me get you in on the conversation. Should we think of this as a new version of the Cold War?
You know, I don't like the comparison, because the Cold War was, I think in many ways a different beast. It was an ideological war of markets versus communism, and individual freedoms and liberalism versus the Soviet version of communism. So I don't think it's a perfect fit that way, but it certainly is a shift to an openly adversarial relationship again between the United States and Russia. I don't think we are doomed forever to be in this situation. And in the past, you know, when Matt and I had a debate in the New York Times, which you may have read.
That's why you're on the show, I should say, because we saw that debate. No, go ahead, Catherine.
That's why we're here together. We're taking our show on the road now.
Exactly.
We have cooperated in the past. So the question is, what has changed here, and why are we suddenly in a very openly adversarial relationship when we were able to, you know, sign arms control agreements and sign agreements that allowed American weaponry and support to travel actually through Russia to get to Afghanistan just a few years ago. And I think that's sort of the interesting question here. The one possible answer is that, well, these sort of lower level disruptive things were going on both sides for years. And so now it's just come out into the open. And another answer is that I think we need to sort of rethink what power is, you know, and again, getting back to your question about the Cold War. The Cold War power was really measured by nuclear weapons and military. Here, the power to disrupt politics, as the Russians have done here with their cyber hacking, is pretty inexpensive. Mm-hmm. And makes it, in a sense, almost more dangerous because it's capable of really hitting at the heart of our political system at low cost. So when we think about what power is and the ability to sort of change the behavior of other countries, then this is I think a new page. So I'd like to talk, about sure. how we got also to this adversarial relationship.
Absolutely. In fact, let me pick up on that. Let me go back to you, Catherine, but I want to hear from you as well, Matthew, which is this personal? Catherine, you've written about the relationship between Obama and Medvedev. I always mispronounce his name, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, the person mm-hmm. who preceded Vladimir Putin. And they seem to get along pretty well. There were certainly agreements between the U.S. and Russia. Then Putin comes into power, and it seems like things change. It feels as if Putin and Obama did not like each other very much. How much of this do you think is a some personal animus between these two leaders?
Yeah, so hardcore political scientists, we're taught or trained to think that that doesn't matter. But I think that it obviously did matter in this case, although it's not determinative, right? I mean, people who don't like each other can still make deals. I don't believe that's the sole reason that foreign policy has made this turn. Certainly, Medvedev, Putin's sort of predecessor as president, but also successor as president. Mm-hmm. And Medvedev, by the way, we don't hear about him much in the West anymore. He is prime minister of Russia still. Medvedev did have a sort of softer presentation of Russia's positions. And I do think that he had a better personal rapport with Obama. And there was a lot of cooperation in that period between 2008 and 2012. But I think what happened is we still had Putin in the background, but he was focused more on economic issues in Russia. And there was some tacit agreement, obviously, with what Medvedev was doing. But there was clearly a break over Medvedev's decision to abstain in the United Nations over Libya and intervention in Libya, if you remember. And this, we see a beginning of a break, I think, between Medvedev and Putin at that point.
Well, let me jump in. Yeah, hold on. And Catherine, we're going to try to get you on a slightly better phone. So once you hang up, we'll call you back and keep our fingers crossed so we can get a better phone line. Let me turn to you, Matthew Rojanski, because you're quoted as saying, and I saw you wrote this down, stop obsessing over Putin. Our problem is with Russia. Interestingly, Catherine Stoner said, Putin is our problem, not Russia. But let me give you a chance about why we should stop obsessing over Putin.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. I mean, Putin is fast becoming maybe second to Abraham Lincoln, the most biographed person in history, and the amount of hyperbole, around Putin is Hitler, Putin is Napoleon, Putin is whatever, Putin is the new Tsar, I mean, there's just this obsession. I mean, I think it's the right word with Putin, and I get it. As a source of entertainment, he's a great Darth Vader. He's a great Voldemort, and it makes good copy. But what it doesn't do is explain why Russians believe what they believe and do what they do. And I think there's a kind of implicit, comfortable assumption in the focus on how Putin has driven Russia's foreign policy agenda, Russia's more assertive role in the world versus, for example, Medvedev's lighter touch or versus Yeltsin's at least early more pro-Western inclinations. I would point out, by the way, Yeltsin's the guy who appointed Putin. So let's not pretend, the 1990s was a story that ended in sunshine and rose petals, right? I mean, the Russians were already very disgruntled with the American-led world order, the American-led vision for European security, especially NATO enlargement, by the middle of the 1990s. So things started to go south. So we absolutely have had other, even post-Soviet, Russian leaders besides Putin who have been quite, let's say, circumspect about being close to the West or being pro-Western. But I think that the key flawed assumption here is the assumption that, you know, but for Putin, who comes in with, however you want to characterize him, some sort of neo-Soviet views or just some innate anti-Americanism, or, you know, he's KGB and that's what he'll always be. You know, John McCain likes to say that's what he sees in his eyes, his soul, whatever. Take Putin out of the equation, and the comfortable assumption that Russians automatically share our worldview, that they basically have subscribed to, you know, free market, democracy, to kind of rule of law as Americans understand it, and also I think to a narrative about, you know, President Obama says it very well, the American view tends to be, echoing Dr. King, right, that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice, right? Russians don't buy any of this stuff, and most of all, they look at the United States as the prime locus of geopolitical power. And in this respect, nuclear weapons still do matter. That's what makes them a geopolitical player. But of course, economic strength matters, soft power matters, conventional military power matters, cyber power matters. Russians look at all this power concentrated in and around America and America's allies, and they say, what have you done with it? Look how you have destroyed the Middle East. Look how you have destroyed and failed to help, you know, our neighborhood of the world. Look what's happening in all kinds of crisis spots in the world where you, America, are just making things worse. So this is the Russian view of the world, and this isn't about Putin. Putin goes away tomorrow. It may be that some of the tone and tenor of the rhetoric coming out of the Kremlin and state-sponsored broadcasting might change, and it might change for the better, but that's not going to flip Russian public opinion overnight, and it certainly isn't going to change a centuries-old Russian worldview.
To you, Catherine Stoner, is very good. And it sounds like a better phone line, so that's good. I'm curious about whether you think part of Vladimir's focus on the United States, his involvement in Syria, focus on NATO, on countries and issues outside of Russia, is a distraction for the Russian people of the problems that they're dealing with within their own country. Is there some truth to that?
There's some truth to it, but you know, I do think people are feeling the economic change in Russia. So, you know, how long the administration in under Vladimir Putin can keep Russians distracted by foreign forays is a big question mark. I would actually argue a little bit with Matt,
sure,
which I think is why we're here, right?
Exactly.
about sort of the quote-unquote Russian worldview. I mean, like the United States, Russia is a very diverse place. And so I don't think there is a sort of singular worldview. Certainly people in power right now are clinging to this idea of, you know, there's Russia has a historical geographic domain and the world is carved up into great powers and the U.S. has squandered the power it has to wreck the world. And now, you know, Russia has a historical destiny to protect itself. And I actually don't buy that because I think we have seen other leaders, as I've written in, before, that have behaved rather differently under similar circumstances. So, I mean, there's certainly some truth to what Matt is saying, but I don't think that's a universal truth. And I don't think it is kind of culturally or structurally predetermined that we will always be in conflict with Russia. And I think even actually Vladimir Putin himself was very open to cooperation with the United States, especially after 9/11, 2001, when he was still a relatively new president in Russia. He was, you know, purportedly the first leader to call George W. Bush and express his condolences about the terrorist attacks in the United States. And he really expected cooperation on terrorism, international terrorism, and viewed the Russians as having a similar problem with a strain of radical Islam, and was disappointed because he didn't get the cooperation that he thought he would get. And also, you know, seeing what the Russians perceive as NATO expansion as a direct challenge to them. And there, I think we have a very different worldview here in the West versus the way that they see the United States and Europe and Eastern Europe in particular.
Let me read some tweets from Donald Trump, and I guess we have to get used to this, tweets from President-elect and then President Trump. Having a good relationship with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. Only stupid people or fools would think that it's bad. We have enough problems around the world with yet another one. When I am president, Russia will respect us far more than they do now, and both countries will perhaps work together to solve some of the many great and pressing problems and issues of the world in capital letters. Is he being naive, Matthew Wojcinski?
Look, I think the impulse that the president-elect has expressed, and he expressed this on the campaign trail, makes sense, which is Russia is one of a handful of countries that you have no choice but to talk to, and probably no choice but to negotiate with if you set out to deal with problems like Syria, like Ukraine. I think the broader problem of world order is one that we are going to be forced to confront if you look at what the Chinese are doing now in the South China Sea, essentially just creating new territory and taking it by military force. It's pretty interesting to see that has become the new normal instead of an outlier. So we're going to have to deal with the Russians, the Chinese, and others on those kinds of questions, which means you've got to have dialogue. The problem I see with the policy up to now is that we have linked two things, I think, mistakenly. One is pressure. That is presenting a strong hand, and you always want to do that. Russians, like many others, respect and listen to someone coming from a position of strength, so we want to make sure the United States is doing that. But we have linked that with this kind of syndrome in American diplomacy of we reward you for agreeing with us by talking to you, and when you disagree with us, we don't talk to you. And I think that's what's failed miserably in the Russian case, because number one, it sends a signal to the Russians that they don't really matter and gives them an opportunity to prove that they do matter by making more trouble. And I think that they have consistently done that and it's worked, and therefore they're going to continue doing that. And second, I think it's taken away opportunities that we might have had to avoid these kind of highly polarizing moments, these tests for American diplomacy towards Russia, like John Kerry over and over going to Sergei Lavrov and basically coming back with nothing on Syria. I think it's a serious mistake to caricature the Russians as saying they are either, sort of aggressive, expansionist, imperialist, bloodthirsty, or they're just like us, but Putin is keeping them down.
Well,
it's a complex place. I agree with
Catherine.
Hold
on to that thought, Matthew, only because we're up in a break. We'll be right back talking about U.S.-Russia relations. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking about U.S.-Russia relations with Catherine Stoner from Stanford University, studies Russian domestic and international politics, and also with Matthew Wojcinski from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Let me read a comment from Mike from Wilmington. We neglect to include in our analysis of Putin's motivations that Obama effectively twisted his arm to remove chemical weapons from Syria. Let me get Suma from Princeton to join our conversation. And Suma, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for taking me.
Sure.
Part of the problem, we have to realize that Putin in particular and Russia in general always want to capitalize on the weakness of America. And in this situation, they've seen the two candidates. They've seen that Hillary already has a vast knowledge of the Russian capabilities, knows exactly what to do to weaken the Russians, and they realized that Obama was weak in terms of some of the actions that they were expecting America to take when China was meddling with us in the Asian Sea, and of course Russia is doing the things that they're doing. They know Hillary's position that would be different. She's more of a hawkish. So they capitalized on that weakness and they went for the candidate that they think they can use against us, and that's where the situation is. The second thing, I blame Obama also. Blame Obama, that particular weakness of him also extended to the point that he could not explain to the American people about the objective of the Russians when this hacking issue was presented to him by the FBI or CIA. He allowed Mitch McConnell, the Republican, Mitch McConnell, I keep forgetting his name anyway, the senator, the majority leader, in the Senate.
Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell. He allowed Mr. McConnell to threaten him, and he did not announce that before November 8th, because if he had done, the result would have been different. A typical Republican president.
Well, you know what, Suma, let me jump in here only because you put a lot on the table, and I'm looking at the clock, and I want to give our guests a chance to respond. But I wonder whether, taking his initial point, Catherine Stoner, whether Putin feared Clinton more than he feared Trump. And of course, we don't know, because Donald Trump hasn't released his tax return, so we don't know what kind of business relations he's had or continues to have with Russian organizations or Russian businesses. What do you think?
So, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about that, and certainly Donald Trump Jr. And Ivanka Trump have been to Russia, to Moscow, to explore business dealings. I think that was a couple of years ago. They've also, you know, obviously Donald Trump ran the Miss Universe pageant in St. Petersburg a few years ago. So, you know, there are rumors, and I want to stress these are rumors.
Sure.
I'm not asserting that any of this is true, but there are rumors that there could be compromise, as the Russians call it, or compromising material that on Donald Trump, that's a possibility, and that they can control him, either filming him with, you know, the women or something like that in St. Petersburg when he was there. So that's one rumor, completely unsubstantiated at this point. I think, though, that that Suma's point about Hillary's positions being more hawkish, I was on her Russia policy team, and so I helped to write the document that was on her website. I was not the lead author of that, but I was a participant. And so some of the positions are definitely more aggressive. The caller is right on that, possibly in, you know, providing offensive weapons even to Ukraine. But the other issue is that, you know, Mrs. Clinton was actually correct, I believe, in her assertion a few weeks ago that Mr. Putin really does not care for her. In particular, he blames her for the popular uprisings that occurred in the fall of 2011 against him when he announced that he would be coming back as president. And he thinks that she fomented that. And, you know, this is his view of politics, which is that things cannot come from below. They must come from above. Somebody orchestrates demonstrations. And so he thought that she, as Secretary of State at the time, had orchestrated this popular demonstration against him. And then knowing that she does have a tendency, she's not dead, just politically, but she does have a tendency to be more aggressive than Obama. That's absolutely true. You know, and I think he did, I think the caller's also right that Mr. Obama did, you know, make some mistakes in dealing with Russia. But he also was not as weak as people think in dealing with Russia over Ukraine, for example. I mean, these are the most extensive sanctions any American president has ever placed on Russia, ever, in history, over Ukraine and Crimea. So, I mean, we did respond pretty strongly there, but Ukraine is not a strategic interest of the United States at this particular moment. So putting troops on the ground was not going to happen. I would also agree with the caller that Obama was perhaps not fast enough in responding to the hacking. But, you know, politically, one can understand why he did that. It's frustrating, though, to have let it go on. But the FBI has some culpability here as well in terms of not alerting him. Apparently, he didn't know until the summer of 2016 that this was happening. So that's a problem. Can I just say quickly, Putin's arm was twisted to remove chemical weapons from Syria. I would have to say no, his arm was not twisted. He was absolutely gleeful to be able to insert himself in Russia as a power broker there and talk to Assad and ostensibly get all those weapons out in 2013. And this really puts Russia back onto the international scene in the Middle East. And so that was a tremendous opening for him.
Suma, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matthew, let me quote something that Michael McFaul wrote in Foreign Policy, of course, former U.S. ambassador to Russia. He said, "Better relations should never be the goal of U.S. foreign policy towards Russia or any country in the world. Diplomacy is not a popularity contest. contest. Rather, better relations must always be understood as a means to advance American security and prosperity. Assuming that's true, what does Russia, what does the United States have in common? What are their shared interests?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with the statement, and I've written the same myself. I think we have a number of potentially compatible interests, but I think what's critical is how you approach the Russians. Where we have failed most of all now is not in writing the right list, the kind of Venn diagram center of minimum issues where our interests overlap. We did do that. Between 2009 and 2011, we got a few things done, and then we didn't really have a chance to rejigger the list. And the main reason for that is that we were not effective in engaging with the Russians. So there are three basic lessons I take from that. Number one, we have to actually know what it is that we want, and not just in relation to Russia. For example, the Syria crisis became very, very acute over the last couple of years. And it's a fair criticism of U.S. policy to say, at the end of the day, we basically had no Syria policy. So going over and over to the Russians and trying to negotiate to get them to come up with a solution for Syria was sort of pointless when our policy was to imagine that some sort of moderate democratic movement could take over in Syria and with our assistance could defeat ISIS and sort of hold the country. That clearly wasn't possible, and therefore we didn't have an effective policy. So we need to know, number one, what do we want? And by the way, I disagree with Catherine. I think Ukraine is absolutely central to European security, which is a vital American national interest. And there we need to know what we want. Again, we cannot deal in the realm of fantasy, imagining that Ukraine was 1,000 miles west of where it is. Ukraine is Russia's neighbor. It always was. It always will be. And that means we've got to figure out a way to engage Ukraine and to engage Russia in a European security system that actually works. And that's not the case right now. We need to have a policy on that. Second, we can't tell the Russians what their interests are. This was a kind of a mistake famously bumbled into by President Bush, the second President Bush, when he came away from a meeting with Vladimir Putin and said, that man just doesn't know what his interests are. Well, that's the thing. You don't get to tell the Russians what their interests are. You've got to actually listen to the Russians, understand what it is that they want and why, not caricature it and imagine that, you know, it's the second coming of Hitler and the Second World War or the Cold War, whatever. Listen to what they're saying. Understand why. I think had we done that, for example, in the aftermath of 9/11, and engaged much more effectively on counterterrorism, had we done that on the Iran portfolio a decade ago, had we done that on Afghanistan, had we done that potentially in Syria much earlier, we'd be in a better position. And then thirdly, this point I made before, which is we cannot treat dialogue as a reward for good behavior. You know, I agree with what Mike says, that a good relationship is not an end in itself. But you can punish and you can pressure while keeping the doors to dialogue open. So the idea of an isolation strategy where part of your punishment is not to talk to the other guy is just fundamentally an error, and it gives them the moral high ground. It allows them to say, hey, look, we're not the ones who cut off negotiations. It's the Americans. Clearly the Americans don't want progress.
Matthew, just briefly, so we can talk to Russia and also keep those sanctions in place?
I actually think sanctions have been largely ineffective so far, but given the political alternatives we had at the time, like, for example, militarizing a conflict between Russia and the United States, obviously sanctions were preferable. Given where we are today, we've got sanctions. They were a huge lift to get them in place. They're coordinated with the Europeans. I think the key is not to give them up in exchange for nothing. So, again, define very clearly what it is that we want in the United States. The sanctions are linked to Ukraine. So if what we want is the roadmap of Minsk, we need to be very clear about the timeline of implementation and exactly what sanctions relief is tied to that timeline. President Obama, about 2.5 years ago, called it a roadmap to sanctions relief. I have not heard him use the term roadmap pretty much ever subsequent to that point. And I think it would be smart to get back to that. The roadmap, sorry, or off-ramp was off-ramp. The term that he used, in order to incentivize the Russians by linking compliance and linking support for these U.S. objectives with the sanctions relief, not just giving them sanctions relief.
Catherine Stoner, Rex Tillerson, one of the many nominees for Trump's cabinet, going to have his hearings this week, or his hearing this week. Former head of Exxon, had lots of business deals, as we understand it, with Russia and some of the former Soviet Union. What kind of questions would you want to ask him at his hearing?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I am obviously concerned about pretty serious conflicts of interest in terms of dealing with Russia. I mean, I think they call it the Order of Friendship from Vladimir Putin himself. He's very close to Putin and one of Putin's closest associates who runs Rosneft. So, you know, I would be concerned about that and about his being possibly, you know, having that relationship taken advantage of in trying. And, you know, I think the concern with Trump being involved as well as Tillerson having this relationship with Putin himself is that they will be more easily manipulable. I mean, getting back to why Putin didn't like Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. Or preferred Trump over Clinton, is I think he thinks he can manipulate Trump, right? And so he sees a narcissist, and by saying quote unquote nice things about him, he can kind of get his way in terms of Russian policy. So I think that's very problematic. The other concern I have is that Tillerson's experience is very narrow and very specific in Russia and frankly around the world, right? It's oil. Oil is a pretty special thing. It's a very highly specific thing. And the goals that he pursued as CEO of Exxon are really rather different than what we would need a Secretary of State to pursue. I would ask him what he knows about Ukraine and the conflict with Ukraine. I would ask him about his perspectives on Vladimir Putin to see, you know, whether he thinks, well, actually he's a great guy and he's completely misunderstood. And again, I would just get back to this issue of only stupid people and fools would think it's bad to cooperate with Russia that Mr. Trump said. I agree with that. It's fine to cooperate with Russia. It's desirable to cooperate with Russia where we can, but we have interests and Russia has interests. And I agree with Matt that you can't tell Russia what its interests are. And Russia can't tell us what our interests are either. Our interests are not solely oil. Our interests are not solely maximizing the profits of American business. And I would want Mr. Tillerson to give me some confidence that that's not his goal alone. We do have an interest in a lasting peace in Europe. And I would agree with Matt there. When I commented on Ukraine as not a U.S. vital strategic interest, I meant in terms of reaching the threshold of putting American troops on the ground. We're not going to do that. Ukraine's not a member of NATO. Would we do that in the Baltics? That's another question.
Sure, sure.
And I would also ask Mr. Tillerson about his perspective and check his knowledge on NATO. Mr. Trump said some scary stuff about dismantling NATO. I would want to know what Mr. Tillerson's perspective is on that as well as asking about, of course, Syria and the Middle East.
And let me
I worry that he doesn't have deep knowledge of
sure.
those things.
And we're less than a minute left to you, though, Matthew. Michael Flynn, he's not going to be confirmed by the Senate National Security Advisor. Seems to have a close relationship with Putin and Russia today. He was feted at an event there. Are you concerned about that?
Oh, look, I mean, what Flynn has said when he was asked was that, you know, this was a paid gig. He was invited to speak, you know, at this dinner. He went to this dinner before he was, you know, in between government service and now his appointment. So, you know, I don't have concerns that he's on any contract with the Russians or Russia Today or anything like that. I think the biggest concern, if he were to have to do a confirmation hearing like Tillerson, and I think a similar question for Tillerson would be, you know, how do you view the interrelationship among the issues that you say you care about? So you say you care about counterterrorism and potentially see Russians as allies to cooperate on counterterrorism. How is that going to work? Because what we haven't gotten yet from the Trump team is a Russia policy or a Russia strategy, and I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, I'd love to talk some more, but we are out of time. Matthew Rojanski, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
Director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Catherine Stoner, thank you very much for joining us as well. Senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.